This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia says it has repelled several attacks by the Ukrainian army as Ukraine admits not advancing in the south and the east as quickly as expected. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that authorizes a record annual military spending of $866 billion. Also ahead, heavy rains and flooding leaves 24 dead in South Korea, prompting evacuation orders in North Chungcheong province. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Russia and Ukraine have released the new reports on their ongoing conflict, with both blaming each other for targeting military facilities, including ammunition depots and air defense systems. Moscow says the Russian military had repelled multiple attacks by the Ukrainian army in Donetsk and Lyman and other directions, destroying tanks, armored vehicles, and other equipment. Russia added its air defenses also intercepted several Ukrainian drones and rockets. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian military said in a report that its forces had engaged in about 20 battles with the Russian army in Kupiansk and other areas. It added the Ukrainian Air Force had struck Russian troops, air defense facilities, and artillery positions. Ukraine further admitted that its troops were not advancing so quickly against Russian forces in the south and the east. EU finance ministers meet in Brussels to try and figure and agree on a €50 billion financial package for Ukraine. New data shows poverty levels within the 27-nation bloc are increasing at an alarming rate. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Charities in Belgium and many other nations across the EU are reporting a huge increase in the number of people seeking emergency food supplies. The growth in poverty was discussed by EU Social Affairs Ministers on Friday.
Social inequality is exclusive, and what we need is a more inclusive society, a more inclusive labour market. And this means that we have to invest in children, poor children. We have to give everybody a new chance.
Energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine are driving EU inflation and interest rates. Those who were already struggling are suffering the most.
We need to see that type of investment, which does bring an economic return and is important for people with disabilities and other disadvantaged groups too. We would like to see that return.
96.5 million people in the EU are now at risk of poverty and social exclusion. That's according to a new report just published by EU institution, the European Economic and Social Committee. The EESC study reflects on record high prices in the EU for goods and services. It calls on national governments to implement measures to help vulnerable families and essential sectors. The institution's report says bankruptcy declarations in the EU have reached the highest level ever recorded. Despite this, EU finance ministers met on Friday to try and agree on €50 billion for Ukraine from the bloc's long-term budget.
It aims to provide a stable, predictable support up to 2027 for Ukraine's macrofinancial stability, its long-term reconstruction, and the reforms needed on its path towards the EU.
Hungary wants peace talks and remains determined to block the money. The country's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "One thing is clear, we will not give more money to Ukraine until they say where the previous almost €70 billion went." Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
China has urged the European Union to avoid vacillating and adopt a clear stance as the 27-nation bloc remains divided over whether to keep economic ties or reduce its reliance on Beijing. Chinese top diplomat Wang Yi told the EU foreign policy chief that the bloc needs to clarify its strategic partnership with Beijing. Wang was speaking with Joseph Borrell on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit in Indonesia on Friday. Wang said China's fundamental interests don't conflict with that of the EU. This comes as the bloc has said it is seeking to de-risk ties with China and is not looking for decoupling from the Chinese economy. The bloc's strategy revolves around reducing its dependency on Beijing for critical raw materials. Some EU member states, however, are worried about antagonizing China and starting a trade war. Elsewhere, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a record defense budget of $866 billion for the next year. The bill was approved by 219 votes against 210, almost exclusively along party lines. The spending package includes initiatives to counter China and an additional $300 million support for Ukraine in its war with Russia. However, a number of amendments introduced by the majority Republicans in the House undermined Democratic support. They include restrictions on abortion health services to the personnel. The amendments mean the legislation will be on rocky ground in the Democratic-controlled Senate. There, Democrats are expected to start the process of passing their own version of the defense policy bill next week. It must also be approved by the House before being signed into law. At least 24 people have died and 10 remain unaccounted for as flooding hits South Korea. Thousands were also evacuated nationwide as a third day of torrential rains caused landslides and overflowed a dam in the northern Chungcheong province. Local government's evacuation orders covered more than 7,000 people at various times. Some trains were also halted or delayed due to safety concerns caused by track flooding and falling rocks. The military has been called in to join rescue operations. The Israeli army says it has arrested a Palestinian man in the southern occupied West Bank over an alleged infiltration into a settlement there. Let's bring in our correspondent in the occupied territories, Ramallah, for this breaking news item. Mona Kandil joins us. Mona, what more can you tell us about what appears to be an act of retaliation?
The Israeli military claimed that a Palestinian infiltrated into the illegal settlement of Asayil or Asayil near As-Samur, south Al-Khalil, southern the occupied West Bank, and the Israeli security forces at the settlement had notified the Israeli settlers to remain and stay indoors, lock the doors and close the windows. Then the Israeli forces claimed they arrested a Palestinian man, was planning to carry out an anti-Israeli operation inside this settlement. The identity of this man is still unknown, or the Israeli military didn't reveal his identity. It's not clear if this is true or not, that a Palestinian was planning to carry out an anti-Israeli operation. Just before he was arrested, the Israeli military also issued a statement claiming that a Palestinian man infiltrated into this settlement, and they opened fire at the Palestinian man. He was injured, and then he was arrested. But later, they claim in a second statement that a Palestinian was arrested and there had been no injuries. So we can't say that he was shot and arrested, or that he was only arrested by the Israeli forces. And if it was true, he was planning to carry out an operation. We have to say that in the past, many Palestinians had been shot, killed, or arrested by the Israelis on mere suspicions. And then the Israeli military revealed after killing the Palestinian or shooting, wounding and arresting Palestinians, that they opened fire by mistake, or that they thought that this Palestinian posed any form of a threat against the Israeli forces.
Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil there joining us live from the occupied territories. Moving on now, a chorus of condolences is coming in following the passing away of prominent Lebanese cleric Sheikh Afif Annabelsi, who was a vocal supporter of the resistance against Israel. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has offered his condolences to the Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement. Iran's foreign minister also hailed Al-Nabalsi's efforts to bring unity among Muslims. Hossein Amir Abdullahian lauded Al-Nabalsi for his courageous stance against the Israeli regime and the support for the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance. The cleric's passing away also sparked condolences from the Lebanese parliament. Hezbollah has expressed grief, saying his passing away is a great loss for the Lebanese resistance. Al-Nabalsi died on Friday at the age of 82. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has wrapped up his three-nation African tour with a visit to Zimbabwe, where the two sides signed 12 memorandums of understanding to strengthen bilateral ties. Raisi visited Kenya and Uganda earlier in the week. He described Africa as the continent of capacities and potentials, saying stronger cooperation would benefit the advancement of both Iran and Africa.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has concluded a tour of Africa. During his trip, President Raisi visited Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. In the Kenyan capital of Nairobi, President Raisi oversaw, along with his Kenyan counterpart, William Ruto, the signing of 5 memoranda of understanding. Raisi said that Iran is ready to cooperate with Kenya in the fields of petrochemicals, agriculture, science, technology, medicines, and medical equipment, as well as the fishery industry and the fight against narcotics. The Iranian chief executive also described his trip as a turning point in bilateral relations, noting that it can create a good market for Iranian products in Kenya and in East Africa. He further emphasized that the ties between Iran and Kenya would not be limited to their borders.
We have historic cooperation with the African continent and Kenya, and believe that relations between the governments and people of Iran and Kenya can expand further. Our goal is to expand cooperation by tenfold.
It is a special privilege to host President Raisi in Nairobi, and his presence is testimony to the strong ties between Kenya and Iran. It is also a demonstration of our shared commitment to cooperate for the benefit of the people of our two countries.
In Uganda, President Raisi called for expanding and strengthening relations with Uganda in various fields. Raisi, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, was officially received by the Ugandan President Museveni at his presidential palace in Kampala. President Raisi called for the development of closer economic ties between the nations and noted that friendly countries need to work together to develop raw materials into value-added products. Two sides also inked 4 cooperation documents. President Raisi visited Zimbabwe in the last leg of his African tour. Raisi said Iran and Zimbabwe have great capacities that can be used in the promotion and development of relations and cooperation between the two countries. The two countries signed a number of MOUs to boost trade. In March, Raisi hosted a meeting with a group of representatives from West Africa, in which he pitched Iran as a different kind of partner when compared with countries in the West with colonial histories in the continent. The trip comes a month after Raisi embarked on a tour of Latin America, where he signed a host of agreements to boost ties with fellow U.S. sanctioned allies Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua.
Iran's view on Africa is quite different from that of neocolonialism or its older version. We seek to transfer technology to Africa and empower the continent. African leaders and their people are now quite sensitive on protecting their independence. This is among commonalities between Iran and African nations. Another issue of equal importance for Iran and Africa is the U.S. sanctions regime. With Africa's assistance, We should prevent the U.S. and certain states that still have a colonial mindset from utilizing the deadly tool of sanctions against nations.
The tour is expected to boost the trade between Iran and African nations. Iran's trade with Africa is set to increase to more than $2 billion this year, from about $1.2 billion in recent years. Raisi's Africa tour is the first by an Iranian president since 2013. Africa is home to 18% of the world's population and is rich in natural resources.
President Raisi's trip to Africa is the first such visit to the continent in 11 years. His visit is primarily aimed at boosting Iran's foreign trade in a region with an economy of $600 billion. Iran exported $1.2 billion worth of goods and services, including petrochemical products, food, medicine, and engineering and technical services to Africa last year. The amount was still not high enough, despite it being an improvement on recent years. Iran, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, embarked on renewing relations with the African people based on Islam's prohibition of racism. The policy of strengthening relations with Africa continued during the terms of the next Iranian president, who paid 41 visits to Africa in total. Trade between Iran and Africa increased between 2005 and 2006, but the global financial crisis and cruel sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic under UN Security Council resolution in 2007 decimated it. Iran expects trade with Africa to hit $10 billion in the next 3 years. Africa is home to 18% of the world's population. With an increasing population growth, it sits on some 30% of the world's mineral reserves, 65% of the world's arable land, and 10% of the planet's freshwater source. It is rich in natural resources, with abundant arable land, water, oil, natural gas, minerals, forests, and wildlife. Experts believe the global economy requires Iran to interact with any opportunities on an international scale and to improve its foreign currency incomes.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Let us suppose I can endure your chastisement. How can I stand separation from you? Who can make such entreat? Who has such love for Allah whose hell one does not feed, while being afraid lest he would be deprived of his love when he goes to hell and degraded to lower station, separating him from God? Imam Ali, peace be upon him, laments of separation from His Majesty. This is the love that thaws in his heart. All actions emanating from him arise from this love for Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio.
I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Hajj. In one of his speeches, he has mentioned that during your circumambulation of God's sanctuary, which is a token of love for God, empty your hearts and of all others and drive out of your hearts fear of things that are not of God. And parallel to your love for the Lord, seek and declare riddance of all small and big idols, the taghuts and their associates, because the Almighty God and His friends have themselves declared such riddance as have done by all the noble and freemen of the world as well. In this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about the idols, about the taghut, which is rebel, the evil, and we need to free ourselves from these things. The main idea is that in the Hajj, we need to learn is to how to release ourselves, how to get the salvation, how to escape from the satanic way, how to release ourselves from getting involved in such things. Therefore, it is necessary that when we are performing the Hajj, and the Hajj which is only and only done for God, obviously, we do not perform Hajj to show others. When a person moves towards the house of Lord, and over there he performs the Hajj, he performs the rituals of the Hajj, and when he performs those rituals, obviously in those rituals, he is not showing off people what he is doing. In that hot weather, with those specific clothes, in that way of staying in the desert, for example, in the Arafat, in the Mina, and, you know, doing the tawaf and all those things that he performs, he is basically bearing a hardship at the time of Hajj. So when this thing is only for God, there we need to seek help from God. The way God has disassociated himself from the taghut, the way the saints, the prophets, the noble people, those who are the friends of God, they free themselves from the taghut, from the evil. So this is the time that we need to also free ourselves from all these evil powers.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions here. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometre front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917, when mustard gas is used for the first time, and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes, with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea, countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thioglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances, whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7, 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some Kosovo, some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm. And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
Take pieces of bread from me, and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
This is this
for
is,
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear listeners, sisters and brothers, the loyal family of IRIB English Radio. Wherever you are, I hope you're just doing well and enjoying your summer, learning new stuff, getting to meet new people and places. And if you're just like me, not too much into getting out in summer, then it's a perfect time to read more of new books or watch more and more of new movies. And of course, listening to more episodes of your very favorite programs on Parsday.com. This is Asma, coming back with a new episode of For a Better Life. So honored and pleased I am for having a chance to sit here and share my comments with you. I am simply a passionate student of English literature, and I enjoy analyzing every single aspect of life. So together we go through some moments of digging deep into different topics, and it's my eternal wish to spark some light on things you might enjoy taking into account. Well, I want to tell a story, but before that, I'd like to raise a question. What makes you cry emotionally? What are the things that would touch the chords of your heart and make you sing the most heart-melting melodies? Has it ever happened to you to look at something and then feel like it's actually so touching to you in a way that you want to sit in a corner and then start crying? Some of those moments, I guess they all happen to every single one of us. But before we go through the story that I was just talking to you about it, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back. Thank you. Stay with us. Yeah, I was about to tell you the story of an old man. It was actually the picture that made me feel like crying so much. Let me tell you the story of an old man who lives in our neighbor. Just coming to the studio, in my way to the studio, I saw this old man. He actually is always there. You know, in their apartment, he opens the window, which is toward the street. I mean, everybody who crosses there would see him and look his face, that he's staring into the street, putting his hand underneath his chin, and then you do not know about what he's exactly thinking. But that image of an old man who is much of a loner, I suppose, makes you feel like life is too much of a miserable thing to pursue or, you know, to go for. So whenever I just see this man, I honestly speaking, I just think of myself, and I just think of the elder people that we have had in our family, and we never care too much about them, as in not that we do not respect them, no, as in we do not give them too much of time. So If I just talk about my grandparents, well, they have not been that alone. I mean, in each city where they lived, they had some people to take care of them. I mean, like their son, their daughters, or anything like that. So they were not as lonely as this man that I'm talking about. But even if we were taking care of them, so according to us, perfectly, but according to them, perhaps there were some things lacking, of course. But when I just see this guy, this old lonesome man, I just think of my grandfather who used to live alone, but then we went and took care of him. So for the morning, he was just all alone. In his lonesome time, he was a kind of a person who was reading too much of books and who read the Holy Book of Quran too much. So he filled the void in his life this way. And he was such a very peaceful person. So he never nagged and, complained about the situation that he was living in. But the truth is that he was having some lonesome moments. So when you're old and you go through lonesome times, through those solitude, you would feel that life is so much of a meaningless thing. And if you are just like the kind of a person who does not have any sort of thing to spend their free times with, then you would be even more sad. Just as I asked that question about what is the thing that makes you cry, for me, one of those things that makes me cry is the thought that I have for the lonely people and for the time they spent in their solitude, especially when they are old, because, you know, it reminds me of a time that is about to come for me. And then it depends on your actually efforts on whatever you have been doing in your lifetime. Then you're going to feel sad or good. If it's sad, then you would very much like to share it with another person. You would very much like for another person to be there with you, take care of you, or show some kind of a love towards you. So this is one of those images that would make me cry. And still, if I just ask you about what is the thing that makes you cry, I'm so sure that right now, many occasions just crosses your mind.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
So, yes, we were talking about the sad occasions that would make you cry. What are the things that would make you feel so touched? And what are the moving images or pictures that you might see or encounter in your life that would make you feel like, okay, I'm so moved, and I would love to sit in a corner and then do an excessive amount of crying. There are some occasions when you're crossing the streets and you see a person with the dignity of a human being, which is so, so valuable to God and to other human beings, of course, goes for begging. Or another thing, very sad picture that would make me wish to cry is the moment when someone is sick and I cannot just do anything for them except praying. Well, those moments are very difficult. I remember I had this uncle of mine whose wife was sick. And then that woman, I used to love and adore her. And then she had this heart disease and nobody could do anything for her. So the only thing that happened is that we were just praying and praying and praying. Those moments, I remember that when that pressure came into me that, okay, I love her so much and I want to do something for her, but I'm just incapable of doing that, made me feel like crying too much. When you try so hard in your life and when you try not to break anyone's heart, and then after years and years, you just come to understand that, okay, there are some hearts that you have left behind you in your way that are broken by the touch of your words or the things that you have done to them without you even noticing it. So those moments also, you feel like a pressure gets into your chest and your heart would feel like, okay, I never meant to hurt anyone, but then that just happened. So try to be always caring about the things that happen around you. Not to be like kind of these people who just do not share any kind of emotion with the surrounding environment. So, yeah, this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session,
I bid you farewell and I leave you to Allah's never sleeping eyes. So, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.